You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Tell me again your question, because I share
how it. Your work relates to
transpersonal psychology. Okay, great. Well, you know what in interpersonal neurobiology, what I have tried to do, and what we and my colleagues and I have tried to do in that field, is to try to stay very, very close to experimental science, that is rigorous, controlled studies that examine, you know, phenomena like attachment studies or studies of relationships from a social science point of view, or looking at, you know, issues of neuroplasticity or neuroscience. So in doing that, I'm not familiar with controlled studies in the transpersonal world, though I've read stuff on that, but we've tried to just stick with those fields of science. So leaving that aside for a moment, in terms of what you're describing about the transpersonal view and, you know, now that I've become involved with people in the contemplative world of all different religious backgrounds, and have had a lot of conversations about this as a scientist and as a clinician, I think there's a huge, huge amount of truth in exactly what you're saying. That, and for me, the link is when you think about energy and information flow. So whether we think about relationships we have with ourselves, or relationships we have, like you and me talking to you, yeah, and I'm talking to you, you and I talking to each other, or to everyone listening on this phone conversation, or to people we're going to all meet after we get off the phone, to people we'll meet tomorrow because of this conversation we've had. All these patterns of energy and information flow, we'll have these reverberating resonances to each other. So I do think there's a way of thinking about, from a systems point of view, thinking about patterns of energy and information flow that use the body, the nervous system of the body, as a nodal point for mediating some of that energy and information flow. But ultimately, this is the way, you know, I think and just the scientific stance, is that it's really a process of relationship. Everything is about the relatedness of one entity to another, so that the separateness of them dissolves. And this is why the earlier question about the puzzlement about me not focusing on relationship was actually puzzling to me, because everything, in fact, is relational. The brain is relational. The transpersonal view you're describing ultimately is about relational things, because you're looking at this large, at least my understanding of it, you're looking at this larger system of entities where we get this false notion of our separateness. And so the transpersonal notion, at least as far as I understand it, is that the individual person is really just a conduit of a much larger process. And I think there's a huge amount to say. We may not have the rigorous, in quote, science about that, but I deeply believe that there's profound truth in that, and I think ultimately we'll be able to know that there's so much that we don't know at this point, but that's absolutely true about the interconnected nature of everything. And does that fit with what you're saying?
Yes, as well as the interrelationship between our various functioning parts. The body playing a very important role in grounding and centering our being by becoming more aware of it in a more deeper way, can bring that balance and bring
into
integrated harmony.
Right. So we have, you know, in our series, for example, the Interpersonal Neurobiology series, we have a book coming out just in a few months on the role of the body and emotion in therapy. We have a book that we've already published called The Body and Trauma and the Body by Pat Ogden and colleagues. We have a series of books all about everything we're talking about, not the transpersonal part, but the importance of the body, the way in which this flow of energy information can be seen ultimately as a relational process, even with yourself.
Okay, I won't keep you. Well, I'm sure there's many other people who want to speak, and there's much more I could say, but I think I'd better get off.
Good, well, thank you. I'll be in New York next September, I believe. So I'd love to meet you in person if you get a chance to come up and say hi.
Where will I come to do that?
If you go to mindsightinstitute.com, it should be up there soon. I think it's going to be at Adelphi University.
Delphi University?
Is it Delphi without the A? Delphi University, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Actually, it'll be October.
October of this year?
This year.
Yeah.
Great, so come up, say hello. I'd love to meet you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hello, this is Tammy Seekirk calling from Huntington Beach, California.
Oh, hi, a local.
Hi there, enjoying the beautiful weather as well.
Yeah.
Dr. Siegel, I've just started reading some of your material. I've read the Neurobiology of We and the Mindful Brain, and I have been just kind of overwhelmed and excited at the convergence of the ideas in there. My work is in organizations, and I'm just wondering, I just see tremendous applicability, and I'm curious, is there anyone studying the application of the research you and your colleagues are doing in organizations, perhaps in studying the pattern of energy and information flow and how that promotes or inhibits integrative functioning in organizations, or some other frame on that? Is anyone doing work in organizations?
Yeah, well, first of all, you can call me Dan.
Okay.
That's a really exciting idea. There's a nonprofit organization called GAIMS, which has a division in it, and GAIMS stands for the Global Association of Interpersonal Neurobiology Studies. And if you go to mindgames.org, you'll find there. And there they have a division where they study interpersonal neurobiology in organizations. So to be very specific about it, there you'll find a number of people who each year we do an applications group where, you know, we all get together and talk about the application of this stuff in the real world. And there's one section of the conference is all about applying this in organizations, so you'll meet people. I don't know if they're actually studying it in the sense of doing research, but they're certainly applying it in the sense of, you know, doing consultations to organizations, and that would be a good place to start. Just from a conceptual point of view, you know, what these people have found, and certainly when I do community work, which I do community organizational work or working with larger systems of organizations, these principles are incredibly useful, and you see these patterns of energy and information flow that can get stuck in certain ways where linkage is blocked or differentiation is blocked because integration requires those two. And by using these principles, you can actually change organizations in some really interesting ways that if you contact me through the Mindset Institute website, I can certainly get you directly in touch with the people who are doing that work, and you can chat with them.
That would be wonderful. I will do that because I've been reading about complexity theory and so much of what you touch on, and it's, like I said, it's just really exciting to see so many different ideas coming together, and it does feel just deeply relevant to organizations, and
yeah.
I would love to learn more about that and see how it's incorporated into my own practice.
That's great. Well, let me know how it goes, and as you already have this Neurobiology of We recording from Sounds True, that recording was about this notion of, you know, what is the foundation of our relationships, you know, this neurobiology of we. What actually allows relationships to have all the dimensions that they have? And I think organizations are just one extension of that, those ideas.
Right. That was a terrific recording.
No, thank you.
That really was. And I love the book, The Mindful Brain, as well. So I'll reach out to you at your Mindsight Institute.
Great. Please do. Please do.
Thank you very much.
And you're welcome.
To you and Kathy and the organization for putting this on.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm glad to be here.
Good.
Hello. This is Lisa from San Diego.
Oh, hi.
Hi. I'm thinking, I tuned in a little late, so you may have already addressed this, but I am thinking that all of us, in terms of integrating this knowledge and this awareness that you bring forth in terms of the increased relationship of everything in different systems in almost concentric circles, that it almost requires us to really change how we perhaps view the world or how we think. And I'm also thinking that it's right on the cusp of when so much of the paradigm of how we view all institutions, be it government, be it health, whatever it is going through this enormous restructuring because it's collapsing in terms of its old definitions, mm-hmm. that it's not easy, in a sense, to integrate the fact that everything is related to everything because it puts it almost demands much more awareness and awareness of our effect on everything.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, please.
And I'm thinking that this is coming up right at a perfect time because I think we are we're questioning so much that the individuality or the separateness has often been, I think, gone in the direction of competition and extreme self-interest instead of perhaps taking the individuality as how does it contribute to all of us, how does it relate to all of us. That is a very different way of thinking, and I'm thinking that it's thinking. I'm just hoping that, in a sense, that it's an opportunity for us to integrate all this and redirect and develop ourselves in a way and interact in a much more mindful way.
Well, Lisa, I totally agree, and I share those views too. Absolutely. I don't know if there was a question there that you want me to respond to, but I certainly share your view that this is an opportunity to really make a shift in the direction of our culture, and even if you just in terms of expanding what you're saying, you know, the opportunity to help people perceive their membership in a we rather than being isolated as just one of a number of separate people in a group. That whole that difference in perspective comes from a perceptual difference. You know, and as they say, you know, there is no such thing as immaculate perception. You know, perception is shaped by these stances we take. And, you know, if we can open up, and obviously it's a certain point of view, if we can awaken the mind to what, anyway, like a lot of us believe is a deeper reality of the interconnected nature of everything, initially it will be hard. And there will be people who don't want to do that and can't do it and refuse to do it. But we need to look ahead, you know, to new generations that perhaps can realize that, you know, not so much as a burden, but kind of as a certainly a reality, but also an opportunity to realize we are a part of everyone, you know, and that's just not some silly philosophical statement. That is a scientific reality, and that if people can start thinking that way, you know, I think the potential of human kindness is tremendous, and I think it's untapped. And I think we're at the verge of being able to really invite that potential into becoming a reality.
Yes, I know. Thank you. I think my question is...
Excuse me.
Should I stop? Someone else in here. I will.
Dan, would you talk about the implications for education?
Sure. You know, this question about the implications for education, I think are huge. Cassie, you need to just tell me if I'm talking too much because I'm so excited about these ideas that I tend to, you know, include a lot of stuff in what could maybe be a sentence.
Yeah, actually, Dan, I was being overly protective of your time. So we are on until 6:30. But I think we had had an agreement from you for an hour, so I was only protecting your time. We'd love
to keep
you. Well,
that's good. You know, until my family comes knocking at the door saying dinner's done and they want me to join the family party.
Wonderful.
I'm happy to stay on.
Okay.
You know, in terms of education, there's a couple things. I mean, the simplest thing to say is, I feel that what general education has done for children has been focusing on areas of skills, of reading, writing, and arithmetic, the basic three R's, that are really fundamental and important, but they're missing the boat. And I think that there's a, if you will, a fourth R and maybe a fifth and sixth R that really need to be put into the foundations for modern education. And these are, the fourth R might be that of reflection. And if you want a fifth and sixth R, it might be of relationships and the idea of resilience or resourcefulness. And to start with the first one, the reflection part, you know, there is in regular standard curricula a lack of the cultivation of a child's understanding of her or his own mind. And teaching reflective skills, what I call mindsight skills, the ability to see the mind in oneself and see the mind in someone else, is something that just doesn't occur for the most part. There are a few programs here and there that do a little bit of this or that, including mindfulness programs, but they're not built into the philosophy of the curriculum, and they're usually not even in the curriculum. And so I think what we have the opportunity to do is to realize that the part of the brain that regulates executive functions, that controls attention, controls impulsivity, is the same part of the brain that's actually our social circuitry that gives us the capacity for empathy and even for insight. This area is an area that's extremely integrative. It's linking widely distributed areas to each other. If you had to put it in one spot, this integrative zone, you'd talk about the prefrontal cortex. And so if we had to change education in some way that is the implication of everything we're talking about, I would say we need to have a policy of no prefrontal cortex left behind. That's a whole different attitude than the present attitude of no child left behind, which is basically teaching the three R's, hoping they're going to perform well on some test that's being administered in some standardized way that has nothing to do with prefrontal ability and nothing to do with something that promotes insight or empathy. And yet we now have the studies. If you look at the program called CASEL, the Consortium for Academic Social and Emotional Learning at CASEL.org, you know, you find that in the last 18 months, they've been able to finish up some amazing studies in over 200 independent school sites that show if you teach reflective skills, in their language, the basis of social and emotional intelligence, if you teach these skills to kids, even their academic performance, which you weren't trying to improve, improves. So principals or deans of schools of education who worry that we're going to lose sight of academic performance by focusing on these reflective skills now have a ton of research that's been carefully collected by CASEL demonstrating that if you teach reflective skills, kids actually do better academically. So it's a win-win situation. We can have people gaining more regulation of their emotions, more capacity to contain their impulses. We have the opportunity for them to broaden their circle of concern, their circle of compassion, as they widen their sense of who they are as an individual, that is, that they could be a part of a larger we. And as they do all of this, it's all promoting well-being. I mean, these reflective skills are a way of creating brain hygiene, because a lot of data suggests that. I review that in the Mindful Brain book. And I think that when we look at it all in this kind of way, just to make sure we're staying with the science, education can have an entirely different approach that the first thing we need to make sure is that these fourth, fifth, and sixth R's, these relationships and resilience on top of reflection, are what we're building. Because this is really what the future is about. And this is, you know, not to replace skills in math and all that other stuff in science. Those are very important too. But without reflective skills, you know, we have an extremely limited person who loses the ability to track themselves. They can't monitor their own energy and information flow. They're not going to have social skills that they need. They're not going to have the capacity to regulate their impulses. In all these different ways, especially with technology increasing, we have the opportunity to redo our approach to education. And I think it can be good for the individual child, it can be good for families, and it can be good for our society.
Great.
I hope
fantastic.
That answers the question. How is that?
That's great. Thank you, Dan. If you're okay with taking another question, I can open
sure.
the lines back up. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much for staying online.
Sure. My pleasure.
All callers are muted and may unmute themselves by pressing 6.
If you have a question for Dan, go ahead with star 6. I actually have a question that was emailed in. Maybe I can
sure.
put that in. Earlier you made the comment that when I open the door for you, I'm actually opening the door for myself. What is the scientific basis for your saying that?
The scientific basis. Well, I think the scientific basis would be a systems theory view that basically says that the energy and information flow that clusters itself in one body that we tend to call a self is a very self-defining, limited view. If you use the word S-E-L-F, self, as to be only what's located in this body. When you expand it to realize that energy and information flow, for example, is what the mind regulates, it's what happens as a sharing process in relationships. It's perhaps what the brain is mediating. Then you realize that energy and information flow, when that person is walking through the door, she or he is just a node in which energy and information flow is finding itself at that door at that time. And if I recognize, as a systems view, that's the science of it, if I recognize, in fact, that energy and information flow is, and I hate to use the word you and me because that even is artificial, but let's just use the word we, that the essence that I'm a part of, I know that's cumbersome, but the essence I'm a part of is now opening the door. And for me, for this body to move there and help the door open for that other body is the same essence. This flow of energy and information is the we that we are. And so I don't know how much more scientific to get than that. I mean, I could talk about neural circuits and all that stuff, or we could talk about relationships, but I think the larger issue, in fact, is this energy and information flow that ties together, you know, bodily functions, relational functions, mind functions, and then you get out of just those separate domains and realize there's this one thing, which is the flow of energy and information.
No, that's great. That's
Jeff, does that address it at all?
That was a beautiful answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan, could you talk more about this human brain creates delusion of separateness?
Sure. You know, it's so interesting to talk about relationships, mind and brain as this kind of triangle, because then you're able to pull out of some of the reductionistic things that some people in brain science say, which is, the brain creates the mind or something like that. So what we're saying is the arrows around that triangle go in all directions. And, relationships are the sharing of energy information. The mind can be defined as that which regulates it. The brain can be that which mediates it. And so what we see then is that we've evolved with certain architectural features where the cortex of the human brain is going to create definitions of tightly bound categories of entities, like a dog, like a book, like concepts of the category of all creatures, things like that. One of those categories is the category of self. So, you know, I have a couple of dogs here by my feet. I don't think their cortex is creating a category of self. They may experience hunger and they may be driven to eat. But we have a cortex, I think, that actually defines a self. If we go back in time, even in our human evolution, I'm not sure self was that big a deal. And I guess the first time I learned about this was my closest friend in college was from Vietnam, and he had escaped as a young child during the war, and he and I would go for long walks, and he had this beautiful thing he said to me. He goes, "Dan, I think I get it. You grew up in this American society, and you and I are both trees, but you really think about your limbs and your leaves and your branches and everything." He goes, "I'm a tree too, but I just think of myself as a part of a forest." You know, and I realized that culture really shapes us, and I think the human brain is susceptible to these cultural influences of defining a self as separate. And once we get that definition going, the cortex can create its own, and I call it a delusion because of what I just responded to Jeff's question about, the science of the idea that we're all part of a we. So I think the cortex, it's not so much the bad guy, it's just because it's mediating a part of this energy and information flow, then there's a tendency in our culture to have a self defined as separate for all sorts of reasons we could spend, you know, a week discussing or spend a year discussing. But assuming that's true, that it's a cortical invention, then we can say, well, because the mind is not the same as the brain, because the mind actually can use the brain to create itself, the mind can awaken itself from the slumber, or, if you will, the prison of these cortically mediated patterns like defining a separate self. And so it's not that it's fate that we have to see this self as separate, but it may be in certain, you know, modern cultural situations that because the cortex is buying into this thought that we're all separate, that we need to do some intentional practice to dissolve those imprisonments of cortical top-down definitions like that. So, I once said this at a meeting where there was different religions were represented, and one of the religious figures got really, really angry with me, and he started saying, one second, let me just give a note here for dinner. Okay, good. So that was my call. I'll have to go in just a moment. So he got angry because he said, well, you know, don't we need to have a self-identity as members of this religion or that religion, you know, and isn't it important that we recognize ourselves as, you know, Christians or Buddhists or Jews or whatever we are, and that identity is important, and you're saying we should all be a part of one? That's ridiculous. We have religious histories and all this stuff. And I understand that he was really upset that it wasn't respecting different cultural views and identities with certain cultural backgrounds, and I can really appreciate that need for him to honor that separateness. But maybe it's my own thing or problem or something, I don't know, but I feel like, why can't we identify ourselves as all part of living creatures? Why does there have to be a definition that makes me feel like someone who's, you know, of a different, you know, species is not as valuable as the human species, or someone who's, you know, not the same, you know, nationality or whatever. So it's just an interesting thing. What does identity really do for us? Separate self, member of this family, member of this neighborhood, member of this country, member of this culture, you know, this religious culture. I think that's it's a fascinating question, so I don't want to, like, be dogmatic about it and say, oh, yes, the only true self is that which has no definitions except that it's all about everything and something. I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but I think there's an opening to the discussion that may be really helpful to engage in about, you know, how do we, you know, loosen up these boundaries? Because this is just one thing I just want to mention is, and I presented this, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, there's a video you can watch of this huge conference we did in Seattle this year, or last year, 2008, with the Dalai Lama, and it was all about the science of compassion. And if you go to seedsofcompassion.org, you'll find there's a five-day conference, and on the first morning of that conference, Friday morning, with three other scientists, I had the opportunity to speak with the Dalai Lama, and in this conference, what I presented to him, which is what I present to you now, is these amazing studies, because I wanted his view on how do we take this notion of a self and in a loving way kind of open it up to questioning, because here's what the neuroscience shows and some other forms of science of threat management. The threat management studies, when you do this thing called mortality salience, you expose someone to a subliminal image of danger, of something, a really violent attack, they will start treating people like them with more kindness, but people not like them with more harshness. And another set of studies shows that if you put a person in a brain scanner and show them an image of a person that they can interpret like them, let's say there's a Korean-American gentleman, and these are, Ivy League kids from, let's say, from Dartmouth. You put him in the scanner, you say, this kid graduated Dartmouth, and now he's at Harvard, and he's, in a dot-com, doing all this computer programming, and he listens to his iPod and all these other things. Well, they can identify with him as like them, similar to them, and their middle prefrontal area, the empathy circuits light up, and everything's fine. A little later in the study, they show the same face of the Korean-American gentleman, only they say, this guy is from Seoul, Korea, he dropped out of school, he plays with Barbie dolls, and he sits and twiddles his thumb, or whatever they say that the person cannot identify with. Same face. Those empathy circuits don't light up at all. Suggesting that, we have the capacity in the way our mind is using the brain, that when we don't see someone similar to us, when we think we can't relate to them, we shut down the circuits of empathy. So this issue of how do we define a self, like I'm an Ivy League kid who only believes in people graduate high school as being like me, clearly that has an impact on whether I even engage the very circuits of compassion of my brain. So this question of how we define a self, if for, let's say, the President of the United States, and, you're threatened by something like 9/11, I mean, that's not, this is a very live thing since the inauguration is next week, how do we approach the larger system view of how we define who we are? And I think there's a lot of reason for us to open this discussion up to consider that an interconnected definition of who we are may be not only more accurate on some systems level, but also perhaps vital for our species.
If I may inject something, Daniel.
I know, Dan. Well, Dan, it's your call. I know you need. I know you've gotten the call to go. So.
Yeah, I have. If I can take just two more minutes, that's fine. Yeah, I'll take one more, and then I should go.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify. You're Daniel Siegel, correct? At Delphi University, and you'll be there in September.
Yeah. Well, it's Daniel Siegel, and I'll be there in October. Actually,
October.
If you go to my website at the MindSight Institute. com, you'll find what should be up there at some point soon is any talks I'm giving. So I'd love to meet anyone on the line in person. There I'll be on October 15th, and then I'll be at Kripalu on October 16th. But the website, there's everything from Australia to Italy to China, and all sorts of stuff should be up there, different places.
Also, for someone who you said at the very beginning didn't have too much knowledge of things of spiritual nature and things in that direction, all I can say is you certainly know a lot about it.
well, thanks. I don't think of it that way, but I appreciate the comment.
And in relation to what we were talking about before, I think the best way to sum up our position is we can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
A deeper interpretation of
that. Exactly. And, we got to take care of the forest of living creatures on this planet, that's mm-hmm. for sure. Well, thank you all so, so much. I've really deeply appreciated being a part of this dialogue, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Dan, and thanks so much for being here, Dan.
Yeah, thanks
so
much for
being so generous with your time.
Yeah. Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, and I'll look forward to meeting you all in person sometime soon.
Okay,
right.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward, Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvy Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Teach. The site offers the latest in community-building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.